Good morning, everyone. It's Candace. I'm coming to you from Autism One Media. Today, my guest is Christina Hildebrand. Good morning, Christina.
Good morning, Candace. How are you?
Good. Christina's with the Voice for Choice, and she's been tracking this SB276 in California. And can you get into that for us, Christina?
Sure. So SB276, for those of you who don't know, is this year's bill on medical exemptions in California, and it's authored by Senator Pan, who had authored SB277 in 2015, which took away all exemptions other than the medical exemption, so the personal belief exemption and what religious exemption we had in California, which wasn't, it fell under the personal belief exemption. And SB276, so during, let me go back to SB277, during SB277, both co-authors, Senator Pan and Senator Ben Allen, made it clear that they wanted there to be a robust medical exemption and that it was at the discretion of the doctor to decide what medical reason the child would be exempted for. And fast forward to this year, Senator Pan, all of last year, during 2018, kept saying that there are unscrupulous doctors selling medical exemptions and that it needed to be cracked down on. So this bill wasn't a surprise to us, in that it, we knew the medical exemptions would be cracked down on. Now let's look at the statistics. We currently have, this last year's school year, had 0.9% medical exemptions. That's less than 1% medical exemptions. And that increased since SB277 from 0.2%. So we expected the increase because a lot of parents didn't get a medical exemption prior to SB277 because their doctor didn't really want to give them one and just said, you know what, go get the personal belief exemption. You need to, all you need to do is sign a piece of paper and then you're good. And so many parents didn't go to their doctor and get a medical exemption. Also, prior to SB277, the medical exemption that was in the law when we had a personal belief exemption was limited to contraindications. And it wasn't a robust medical exemption that we have since SB277. And so this year, Senator Pan introduced SB276, which would, and it has gone through amendment. So initially, it required medical exemptions to be accepted or denied by the state, by the public health department. And that would, our big issue with that is it takes away the doctor-patient relationship. It basically supersedes your doctor in saying, yes, this person should have a medical exemption, and they've looked at family history, they've looked at genetics, they've looked at past vaccine reactions, they looked, you know, at a whole broad spectrum of things and decided that you are not valid for, or that you're valid for a medical exemption. Now, the state could come in and say, yeah, no, we don't agree with that. And they could
Christina, I have a really quick question.
Yep, no, go for it.
So is that the state health department or the county health department?
It's the state health department
okay.
That has the final say, yes or no. So the bill got heavily amended prior to the Assembly Health Committee, which was heard a couple of weeks ago. And it was amended heavily and now is a 21-page document that really, between you and me, is a complete mess. There are so many unanswered questions. We actually put together, we analyzed the amendments and within 24 hours put together a document about 30 to 40 questions that were left unanswered. So basic things like the word fraudulent. How is a fraudulent medical exemption defined? There's a piece in it that says if the doctor poses a public health risk, then they're not allowed to write medical exemptions for 2 years. Well, what's posing a public health risk? What does that mean? There were so many questions left unanswered that we gave those 40 questions to all the assembly members that were on the health committee, and they definitely made some changes both prior to the health hearing and to the health committee legislative analysis has a whole bunch of amendments that they recommend, and then there were also additional amendments taken in the committee. And so we haven't seen the final the final result of those amendments hasn't been published. We're expecting it to come out today or tomorrow. We have seen a sneak peek of them, and it does, I would say, it rectifies some of what issues we had, They have taken out the word fraudulent, so that's no longer in there, but they haven't taken out the poses a risk to public health, so, you know, that's still an unanswered question. They have done things like, for example, the medical exemptions that have been written to date will be grandfathered in, basically, but you have to upload them. But you have to upload them to a database. So we still have an issue of, like, why do you need to do that? Why do you need to, you know, you've got them on file in the schools. They've been accepted. Like, there are very few laws that go back in time and reprimand you or make you do something additional for stuff that was legal and followed the correct practice during the time, you know, during that time prior to something going into effect. And so that's a, you know, we're happy that they're grandfathered in. And I will say these are amendments that we have seen a sneak peek at, but I, you know, until they're in print, don't hold me to any of this. But so the grandfathering in is there, which we're happy about. The database we're not really happy about. There are other pieces, for example, the previous amendments had that if you were going through the appeals process, you still had to put your kid on a conditional vaccination schedule. So even if you win the appeal, you are basically told, well, for your kid to go to school, they have to start the vaccination process. That has been taken out. And so you can go through the full appeals process and not have your, and your child can go to school and doesn't need to be vaccinated until the appeals process is over. Another place that we're sort of still concerned about, or you know, they say they fix. So the big issue and the issue that Gavin Newsom, the governor, had with this bill was that it took away that doctor-patient relationship and put it in the hands of a state bureaucrat. So what's interesting is they say, oh, we fixed that problem because now a state bureaucrat can only revoke a medical exemption. They don't accept or deny. They don't review. They just revoke. Well, you know, by default, if somebody has the right to revoke an exemption, then they're also accepting the rest of them because they're reviewing the rest of them. So, while the linguistics is different and it sounds like all they can do is revoke, by default, they also are accepting those that they don't revoke. So that's an issue. Other issues that we have with it, there are triggers that if a doctor writes five or more medical exemptions in a year, they will be reviewed, and we don't really understand what reviewed. Would just those five, the first five, would be reviewed? All of their medical exemptions from then on out would be reviewed. The other piece of that is most doctors write more than four medical exemptions a year. We know, so as I mentioned before, 0.9% of individuals have medical exemptions in school, children in school in kindergarten this year. We know from the Harvard Pilgrim study, the Lazarus study, that 2.6% of people had vaccine injury. They documented that. So we would actually expect the medical exemptions to be much higher than that. We also know, if you look at the MMR data that shows their clinical trials, that 10% of people with MMR had a severe adverse reaction to the MMR vaccine. So if you've got 10% of people having a severe adverse reaction, then you would expect those people to have an exemption from another dose of that. Not under SB 276, but, you know, in reality, a doctor, if you've had a severe adverse reaction to a vaccine, they would write a medical exemption. Now, the other thing to remember about medical exemptions is that they are for one or more vaccines. So you could be fully up to date except for one vaccine that you've had a reaction to. It's not a severe enough reaction for the CDC to say you shouldn't be vaccinated again, but your doctor decides that and gives you a medical exemption for that one vaccine. You're counted in the database as having a medical exemption. Doesn't specify whether it's for one vaccine, all vaccines, two vaccines, what it is. So, you know, that's another piece that isn't really being, you know, the whole story isn't being told here because we don't know what that medical exemption, in most cases, what that medical exemption consists of. So going back to the doctors who write five or more, they get reviewed. The issue there we also have is that temporary medical exemptions are included in that. So, for example, if a child comes to their well check visit, and they're sick, they have a cold, or they're on antibiotics, in order for them to continue at school, they have to have a temporary medical exemption until the next time they see their doctor and get that shot. Well, you know, what are we doing to doctors? If doctors don't want to get reviewed, you know, are they going to give that shot to the child who's sick just because it's easier to do it that way than have themselves reviewed? It's putting the doctor in a precarious place. It's also putting parents in a precarious place. So I have a medical exemption for my kids. It's backed up by two other doctors. I don't believe it would hold under SB 276 because it doesn't apply to the CDC contraindications, and we'll get into family history versus contraindications, but it doesn't fit under SB 276 as I believe it. So I have three doctors that have told me that this is, you know, that my children are at a higher risk if they get vaccinated. And the state would say, oh no, for your kids to go to school, they would have to be vaccinated. So what do I do? Do I listen to my three doctors, one of which is the top expert in the world on Asia syndrome? Do I listen to my three doctors, or do I, you know, put my kids in school and have them vaccinated, knowing that somewhere between shot one and shot 59, they're going to get injured? Like, I can guarantee you they will be injured because I know they have a higher risk of being injured. And so, you know, and I have a 13-year-old that's going into high school that wants to go to high school. There's no way I can homeschool her in, you know, advanced biology and whatever other amazing courses she's taking. But there's no way that I can homeschool her. I can't move out of the state because I'm divorced and my kids are staying here. If I leave the state, they're not coming with me. And so I think they're putting people in these precarious positions where they have to choose between their doctor and what the state's telling them to do. You know, I think it is, what I would like to see is what the heck is going to happen when that child, and there will be more than one, gets vaccine injured because the state has said they should go ahead and get vaccinated. Who's liable for that? You know, we're putting the state at a place where they are taking on a lot of risk because you can't sue the manufacturer and you can't sue the doctor that gave the vaccine. And you're going against your doctor's orders. You know, what happens then? So there's a lot of questions in this that are left unanswered and that really don't, you know, and all of the things that I've talked about don't really go after the doctor. They penalize the child for an error if their doctor is selling medical exemptions, which we haven't seen any proof of. But if their doctor is selling medical exemptions, then that's on the doctor. That's not on the parent that went to that doctor and got a medical exemption. You know, if a doctor sells opioids and is, you know, script selling, you know, it's not the person who gets the opioids that is charged, it's the doctor that's charged or that's questioned. And so this bill goes so much further than what Senator Pan says is the issue. You know, if there are unscrupulous doctors selling medical exemptions, which again, there is no evidence of that, but if there are, we're in complete agreement. We don't want those doctors out there. They shouldn't be script selling. They shouldn't be handing over a piece of paper for whatever amount of money. We agree with that premise, but this bill doesn't address that. It goes so much further in sort of curtailing the medical exemption from a patient perspective rather than from a doctor perspective.
Now, Christina, let's tell us where the bill has been and where mm-hmm. it's at now. I mean, it went through Assembly Hill. Now, did they make all these amendments after it had already been approved by Assembly Hill?
No. So there were a huge number of amendments that came out the Monday before the Assembly Hill hearing, and those were the ones that we had questions on. The legislative analysis, which is the analysis done by the Assembly Hill Committee, brought up a bunch of questions and said, these are the amendments we recommend. In order for it to get out of this committee, these are the amendments we recommend. Those amendments, plus there were additional amendments based off of our questions that we had put forth, that the Assembly Health Committee had sort of rough drafted. So they'd gone through the bill and, you know, rough drafted things and changed things that were taken, what's called taken in committee. So Senator Pan had agreed that if he took the legislative analysis plus these additional amendments, that was what was coming out of the Assembly Health Committee. We and it seems like a really long time. I think we've been told legislative council is extremely busy. I don't know if there's more than that to it. But those amendments should have come out of legislative council by now. We're hoping to see them today for sure or tomorrow. As I said, we got a sneak peek at them, which is what I'm basing this conversation off, but don't quote me on it until they actually come out, because legislative council and the health committee could change things.
Okay. So we're waiting for
these amendments. Then once these amendments come out, I believe they have to come out before the Appropriations Committee. So it next goes to the Appropriations Committee, which will be heard probably next Wednesday, July 10th. That committee hearing, the Appropriations Committee is an interesting committee because they vote on the bill twice. So they vote, first of all, to put it on the suspense file, which any bill that has over $150,000 worth of financial impact to the general budget has to go into the suspense file. So that's the vote that will happen on July 10th, on next week. The financial impact is based off of all of the things that are in the bill, and so it has to be amended before it goes to appropriations because they need to see what the financial impact is. Once it goes into the suspense file, it's held there until the end of August. So you have to remember the legislature is on vacation from July 12th to August 12th. So we're really talking we've got two more weeks in this piece of the session. Then they're on vacation for a month, and then they come back August 12th, and we have another 2 weeks until appropriations looks at the suspense file. And basically, the suspense file is all the bills that have a fiscal impact, and the Appropriations Committee has a budget from the general budget that they have to stay within. And so they look at all the bills and the financial impact of all the bills, and they allow out whatever fits that budget. Now, it's a bigger budget than the actual general than the general budget, because they know the governor's going to veto some of them, and some of them may not pass the assembly floor. And so they basically then let out of suspense a certain number of bills that fit within this budget, and then this bill will go to the assembly floor, which will happen sometime after August 31st, in the next sort of 2 weeks after that. And then after that, it goes back to the Senate for concurrence, which, because the bill has changed since it came from the Senate, it will go to the Senate for concurrence. And, people have said, oh, well, maybe we can kill it in the Senate. If we don't kill it on the assembly floor, we can kill it in the Senate. The likelihood of not, like 99.9% of bills are concurred in the Senate. So it is, really unlikely for that to happen if it is passed the assembly floor. Once it goes to the Senate for concurrence, if it passes the Senate, which, as I said, is very likely, it goes to the governor's desk. And the governor has a month from when it goes onto his desk to either sign it or veto it. If he doesn't veto it and he doesn't sign it, it becomes law. And by de facto, it's like him signing it.
So, database. Let's talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
Don't we have a choice? I mean, don't we have a right to privacy?
Yes and no. So, yes, we should. I think there are two places that the argument is different. So one of them is, if you want to have a medical exemption, you need to sign the document that says your data can be released to certain entities. And so it's kind of a catch-22 situation that if you don't sign that, then you don't get a medical exemption. I agree that it's, that shouldn't be the way it is. It is not part of HIPAA, because once you release your documents from your doctor, they're no longer covered by HIPAA. It's not covered by FERPA, which our current medical exemptions are in schools, because the school can't give out the information with personal information on it. So it kind of circumvents both of those, and your data gets uploaded to the database. The interesting thing is the database that they're talking about using going forward for this is the CARE database, which is the California Immunization Registry. So if you have, if you, your children or you have ever been vaccinated, or I shouldn't say ever, if you've been vaccinated in about the past 5 to 10 years, your vaccination information would be put into the CARE database. Regardless of whether you want it there or not, it will have been submitted to by your doctor into that database, or it should have been submitted. Let's put it that way. There are some doctors that don't submit information to the CARE database because that's their prerogative and that's their choice. They should be. Not that I think, you know, they should be according to the state. I don't think they should be, but according to the state, they should, everybody should be entering it. The thing with CARE is, and this is the interesting piece of it, so you can opt out of CARE. What that means is it doesn't mean to say you can opt out of having your information put in there if you're vaccinated. You can have your information not be shared with third parties. So CARE, one of the issues we have with CARE being the database that's used, is a privacy issue on this. So right now, CARE is accessed by many third parties. So it's accessed by schools, school districts. It's accessed by WIC. It's accessed by the foster care, folks. It's accessed by other CalWorks, other state organizations. And basically, it's used that if somebody comes into one of those entities and they say, we need your vaccination records, and the parent says, I don't have vaccination records, you know, I've moved, or my doctor is no longer practicing, or, you know, it's been 10 years since they were vaccinated, I don't have those, the first thing that those organizations will do is query the CARE database, and they'll put your name in, and they have to be, you know, they have to have signed up for confidentiality, mm-hmm. quote unquote confidentiality, but they have to have signed up for the confidentiality bit, but, you know, I don't trust all of these people having access to it because they can pull your information, they can print it out, and so they have access to it. So the question then becomes, you know, and if you opt out, they don't have access to it. So it just comes up saying no data available for this person. But my question is, you know, what information will they have on the medical exemption stuff? So, you know, mm-hmm. will it say so-and-so has a medical exemption, or will it say so-and-so has a, so-and-so has a medical exemption, and this is the reason for the medical exemption. You know, they are HIV positive, or they are immunocompromised, or they are, you know, have cancer or whatever it is, you know, and now that person has identifiable information, you know, health information. So it is concerning that CARE is the database. They haven't made it clear how the medical exemptions will be input or what data will be output from CARE, but it is concerning.
So what would this bill cost, say, to California?
So it will cost at least, well, and that's, so it's hard to say, and it's part of what we're looking for the amendments for, and we have questions outstanding, is how much will it cost to adapt the CARE database? Because prior to the CARE database being used and what was quoted as a new database being created, it was somewhere between 10 and 30 million a year. And you have to understand this is for 4,000 kids and 0.9% of our school population. So it is a huge amount of money for a tiny number of people. That, you know, if you ask me, there are much better places for that money to be spent. There are the database, if it is using the CARE database, then some of the upfront costs of setting up a database, which are the most expensive, are mitigated. Having said that, CARE doesn't have any place for medical exemptions or any place for that information. So they would have to create a piece of CARE. They would have to upgrade CARE. The other interesting thing is that there are 6 counties that don't use CARE or are not, their system is not integrated with the CARE 2 system. And so they would have to use separate databases, and their databases would also have to be updated in the same way CARE is. It's not clear that when those, you know, it's slated that those 6 counties will be incorporated into CARE at some point, but it's not clear when that happens. And so for now, those 6 counties have to have their own uploading and privacy and all the rest of it included. So it's somewhere in the realm, I think, now of somewhere between probably 5 and 10 million in the first year, and then probably, you know, probably 2 to 6 million in subsequent years, as far as we can tell from the amendments that we've seen.
So do you get, I know you like to deal in facts, mm-hmm. do you get any kind of a sense on which way this bill is going to go?
I think it will get to the governor's desk. I think Senator Tan has done what he did with SB 277 and what he's done with this bill in the past, which is he has told legislatures, we fixed the parent-doctor-patient relationship, we're grandfathering in, we are, you know, we are going after these unscrupulous doctors, that's the main focus. And that's what he's selling to assembly members. And that's where, you know, what he's selling isn't what's in the bill. And he does this a lot, and he's, you know, notorious for it. The other interesting thing, so the Assembly Health Committee hearing, he went off for about 5 minutes total on how scientific data, if your doctor says there's a risk to you because of something, so his, you know, his statement is vaccines don't cause autism, unless I understand that is a very controversial topic, and, you know, I have differing opinions on the science of that. But let's just say that's a true statement for the case of this argument, okay? I'm not getting into whether it is a true statement or not, but let's just say it is. He said, you know, that you can't use as a medical exemption example. But if something has not been proven, then we have to side with the child. So, for example, if it hasn't been proven that vaccines cause
autoimmune disease.
Well, let's take a specific autoimmune disease, because autoimmune disease is very, very wide. So vaccines don't cause, what did you say, eczema?
Eczema, yeah.
Yes. Or vaccines don't cause, let's take something even more serious than that, psoriasis, right? So vaccines, it has not been proven that psoriasis is not caused by vaccines. And so his statement was, if you have something like that, then we have to go, and you believe you got psoriasis after a vaccine, or you have an elevated risk for psoriasis, then you have to go with the child and err on the side of caution, then say, no, that doesn't count because it hasn't been proven, which is the way the vaccine court works. And the way most things with vaccines work is if there hasn't been shown causation, you can still go on that this happened within a certain period of time afterwards, or that you have a higher risk and you know, you can move forward with it. So based on that, let's go back to something that I brought up, which is family history and contraindication/precaution. And what the definition of a medical exemption currently is in this bill. So it started off as just CDC contraindications, which are the tightest reasons for not being vaccinated. And what that was is you have to have anaphylactic shock, or so you stop breathing, or encephalopathy, which is your brain swell, for each vaccine, and then you are not. Then you're exempt from getting those that specific vaccine again.
But you have to get all the rest.
You have to get all the rest, yes. So if that happens for the hepatitis B shot, oh, you're fine getting the other 10 shots nine diseases that are on the list. He expanded that then to include precautions. So precautions are things that are usually temporary. So, for example, if you have a cold, you shouldn't get some of the vaccines. And so they would be temporary things that resolve themselves over a short or longer period of time. Another one is if you're immunocompromised or if you're undergoing chemo treatment, then you shouldn't get the live vaccines, the MMR or the varicella vaccine. So those, it expanded it a little, but it really didn't expand it for anyone that, for example, if your child had seizures from a vaccine, ongoing seizures, doesn't count. The sibling doesn't count either, which in SB 277, family history and genetics were taken into consideration. So then he expanded it in the latest amendments that we've seen, the ones that came out before the health committee, to CDC, and this is very specific wording, so listen carefully, CDC, ACIP, which is part of the CDC, who determines what goes on the schedule, and AAP, the American Pediatrics Association. Their criteria for medical exemptions is what the wording in the bill is. You go and ask the CDC. They say we do not have any criteria for medical exemptions. We have contraindications and precautions, but ultimately it is up to the, those are guidelines for the doctor. It ultimately is up to the individual doctor to determine whether their patient should be vaccinated or not, i.e. whether they should have a medical exemption or not. So that, they don't have any criteria for medical exemption. And ultimately it's at the discretion of the doctor. But when you look at the, you know, even if you use the guidelines, the contraindications or precautions, they don't include family history. Sorry, they include family history on a tiny portion, and I'll get to that. The ACIP also has no medical exemption criteria, and they refer back, if you ask them, well, what are your guidelines for vaccination, they refer back to the CDC guidelines, specifically refer back. Now, if you ask, Senator Pan was asked this in the Assembly Health hearing, and he said, oh, no, they do their independent research, an independent determination, and they may happen to look like the CDC because the CDC is, you know, they all look the same because that's the standard of practice. Well, that's not true. ACIP specifically refers back to the CDC. We also sent AAP an email saying, you know, what are your criteria for medical exemptions? And he said, and they said, oh, we go with what the CDC guidelines are. We don't have any of our own. We go with what the CDC guidelines are. So everybody refers back to the CDC guidelines and their guidelines. So there aren't criteria. There aren't check the box criteria for this. So.
And that would be a conflict of interest because they actually sell vaccines to county health.
Well, yes, that's a whole another issue of this. So let's go to family history. Family history is mentioned twice in the bill. It's mentioned once at the beginning, which is the most infuriating piece of this bill because it's the first, and it's cleverly tactically done by Pan. It's the first paragraph, which is existing law, and it says it's at the doctor's discretion. It can include family history. It's not limited to that. Basically says all the things that a doctor can use to write a medical exemption. But those aren't the things that the State Health Department will use to review the medical exemption. So realistically, you're saying, oh, the doctor can use their discretion completely, but when it comes to the state reviewing these medical exemptions, we're not using any of that. We're only using these criteria, which don't exist, but whatever these criteria are, these are the only things we're using. So, you know, the legislators look at, and I'm saying this so that people listening to this know what the talking points are to take to their legislators, because we've had legislators say to us, but it's in the first paragraph of the bill. Can you not read, Christina? It's in the bill, and it is very nuanced. But yes, it's in the bill. I agree. It is stated in the bill. Family history is stated twice in the bill. First time there, but that's not what the doctor is reviewed on. That's not what the medical exemptions are reviewed on. So realistically, that goes out the window because you can really only use the criteria you're reviewed on because those are the ones that are the only ones that are going to be accepted or revoked. The next time it's used is it's used saying that, first of all, the doctor has to upload a form that says, you know, basically the criteria. If you don't fall in the criteria and they're using family history, they can give, then goes to the second slot or the second review, second level review. And at that point, they can give more information about family history and they can sort of plead their case on why family history is important and why it's relevant and why it should be considered. Now, that family history states that it has to be family history relevant to the standard of care. So Senator Pan's answer to that was, well, yeah, we have to have the word relevant standard of care because we don't want – everybody has a family history. So you can have a family history of, somebody who likes to jump up and down. That doesn't qualify, and I agree, that doesn't qualify for a medical exemption. So the family history should, yes, relate to and our request is that it isn't relevant standard of care, but it's relevant to the vaccination and relevant to current research or is cited by current research, something in that realm. When you do relevant standard of care, the standard of care refers back to the CDC. And the CDC family history is very minute. So if you have an immunocompromised family member, then you're exempt from the MMR and varicella. So the family history, or if you have a family history, there's two or three different chronic disorders that if you have a family history of, then you are exempt. But it is very, very tight criteria. It's not like, oh, family history. Most of our doctors, if you look at the medical exemptions they write on family history, it's not on one person's family history. It depends on the closeness to you or to the patient of that happening. So if they have a sibling who has had terrible reactions, then that counts more than if a grandparent had a vaccine reaction or if parents have autoimmune disorders. But the doctors are looking at the whole picture and the whole family history, not just one or two things. And so, you know, that statement of relevant standard of care, it is not family history as we know it in SB 277, and it's not what doctors are using to give medical exemptions. And so again, you know, it says family history twice in the bill. Does it refer to true family history? Does it refer to genetics? I mean, the other piece of this is the research that's come out in the past 5 years on genetics and autoimmune disorders and vaccines and autoimmune disorders is huge. And none of that is captured by the CDC. And so you have to leave it open to relevant research and relevant current research, as well as family history. So true family history. So there are issues on that piece of this bill as well.
So when do these legislators and assembly people come home so we can go visit them?
Between July 12th and August 12th. Now, they are on vacation for some parts, but you should be able to meet with them in their office sometime during July and August. The other thing that they do, and, you know, we've heard from many legislative offices, oh, we're done with meetings. We've already met with enough people on this bill. We don't need to meet with any more. And my recommendation, if you get that response, is find out where their public events are. And I wouldn't mention when you call that you're on, you know, opposing SB 276, because you're probably less likely to be told where they are.
Well, that's not really fair, because they're supposed to be representing all of us.
I understand that, but I would pull up not stating your position or not why, just you'd like to know when their public events are. And they often have coffee mornings. They, like in the summer, there's a lot of fairs, parades. You know, 4th of July is a big one for the 4th of July parades. Look who's going to be there. And the key with that is, you know, you have to be polite when you're talking to them. But the key when you get into one of those situations where they are there in person is being able to say to them, I would really like to meet with you. And I really need to discuss some issues that are going on in our district that I want to meet with you on. And I wouldn't necessarily, again, I wouldn't necessarily say what topic you want to meet on. And if they ask, I would also have a number of bills. I wouldn't just select SB 276 because they will say to you, well, we've already met with a whole bunch of constituents on that. Send me an email with your concerns, kind of thing. And you really want to talk to them in person. So
yeah.
I would find what's important. I mean, they've all got at least 20 bills that are going on, you know, or they had at the beginning of this session. Some of them didn't make it through the first house. But for the most part, they've got somewhere between, you know, 10 and 20 bills that they are working on themselves. Find a bill of theirs that you like. So there's, you know, there's education bills, there's special needs bills, there's charter school bills, there's homeschooling bills. There's a whole bunch of different bills that they are focusing on that are their pet projects. And they're much more willing to talk about their pet project, and especially if it's a bill you support of their pet project, than they are of anything else. And so I would say, you know, go in and say that you want to meet on a variety of topics, you know, and mention some of them and sort of do SB 276 so here are the issues, and, you know, oh, by the way, I also want to talk to you about SB 276. You'll find that you get a much better response from getting a meeting with them than if you just flat out say, I want to come talk to you about SB 276, because they've gotten a lot of calls and a lot of emails and a lot of meetings.
Create a relationship and help them out where you can. Maybe volunteer.
Yes. I mean, I would say, yeah.
Christine, I got two more questions. I'm sorry. Yeah.
No, go for it.
Now, during this whole process, did anybody bring up that HHS hasn't done a single safety study and presented it to Congress?
No, and that's purposeful. So that is a federal issue, and states will say that's a federal issue. There's nothing we can do about it. The other piece of this, and it's where we've actually gained traction on this bill, and I know there are a lot of people that on our side that say, well, come on, it's an education point. Is that we have focused on the doctor-patient relationship and on the vaccine injury criteria and on other things rather than making this a vaccine issue. You know, vaccines were legislated during SB 277 in 2015, and legislators, even the ones that are educated, are unwilling to go public on it because they need the CDC or somebody else in authority to say the truth about vaccines. So, you know, for them to come out and say, and we see it, you know, I mean, we saw it with Jessica Biel went up there, and her issue with vaccine safety and ensuring that medical exemptions are given to those that really need them. That was her platform. It wasn't anti-vaccine. It wasn't anything else. That was her platform. And she got hammered for it and nailed for it. And so these legislators aren't, and this isn't just on the vaccine issue. It's on every issue out there. To get a legislator to step out on shaky ground that doesn't have any government backing is close to impossible. You know, we've been trying to get the glyphosate issue legislated. We've been trying to get glyphosate out of school grounds, Roundup, out of school grounds. We've been trying to get it out of you know, proper state or city property, county property. That has only finally taken footing now that there have been lawsuits. Even with the lawsuits, the one bill last year was changed into a study bill. The bill this year was canned in the assembly. It's come back to life again. And I'm hoping that it does make it through. It's in a slightly different form. But it is close to impossible to get legislators to move on things that haven't been proven when, you know, and the reason they're saying glyphosate is, well, the EPA just came out and said it was safe. So if we're going, and the EPA is a tricky one in California because they understand that Trump's doing a lot of environmental stuff, and it's the reason why I think we may be able to get this glyphosate-free bill through. But they are very much looking at the governmental organization. If you step out and go against the CDC, I can guarantee you that the Democratic Party will get rid of you in the next election. You're gone. You're done. You're history, kind of thing. And so it isn't something that we haven't brought up the vaccine safety issue. We haven't brought up those issues. There are issues we bring up constantly in the off-season of politics. So between September and January, we will go and educate legislators on what's actually going on with vaccines and what's going on federally and what, you know, those sort of to give them the piecemeal and sort of spoon feed them on that. But we don't do it on this bill because it doesn't help our cause. The minute a legislator hears, oh, you don't believe in vaccines, well, then, you know, I don't want to talk to you. You're a quack. And we've made real strides on the pure core issues, the policy issues of this bill. And so it muddies the water. You know, that's not what people want to hear, but we're in the business of killing this bill. So we're not in any, in whatever way we can. So.
I'm crossing my fingers that it won't go through, but just in case it does, when would it take effect?
So I do think it will go through. I think we will have, I'm hoping we will have the best bad bill ever. I do think it has got momentum, the assembly is 80 people, so we have to get 40 votes if we want to stop it. It's a lot of people to corral. I think Governor Newsom will sign it because he believes that the doctor-patient relationship issue has been taken care of. We need to, you know, those are talking points we need to address. If it goes into effect, it'll go into effect most likely January 2021. That's what it's slated at the moment in the bill. There's a possibility that HHS comes back, California HHS comes back and says, we can't make the changes to the database, to the care database in a year. So we need to do it. We need more time. But at this point, it is slated to go into effect January 2021.
Now, there was some scuttlebutt that I was reading on the internet, and let's just clear that up right now. So that bill that, I don't know, who was it, somebody presented the communications people about your volunteers visiting your house to judge you on your parenting and the medical, social. Yeah, so can you clear that up for us? What's going on with that bill?
So the home visiting bill was not passed last, well, no, one version of it is, but it basically, actually, I don't know whether it was. It was basically incorporated into the budget. Gavin Newsom has a very strong policy that he put forward while he was being elected, which is he wants to take our children from cradle to job. So from 0 years old, the minute, actually minus 9 months, to, 21, 25, whenever they're getting their first job. Probably, 18, 21, 25, depending on whether you get to college or not. He believes, basically, that during that time, the state knows, I'm not going to say best, but the state knows very well how your children should be cared for and what should happen to them and for them. And so the home visiting piece is an important part of that, he believes, because, his belief is you have home visiting, you have daycare, you have preschool, you have mandatory kindergarten, and then you have, the state take care of your kids in school. And so a lot of that was incorporated into our budget and is happening. Now, other pieces of that, so if the state truly was doing it out of the best interest of the child and the parents, the family, I would have less concerned feelings about it. But many of these, the home visiting basically is, and it's premised on, we're coming in because there are parents who are in low income, and it's very much targeted at low income. There are parents in low income families, and they don't know what they have access to. So, they have access to places where they can get diapers. They have access where they can get this. They have access where they can get this. They have access where they can get vaccinations. All of these things that, and if it were just coming in and saying, this is what you have access to. We want to make sure that, your child is thriving. But there's an under connotation of that, of they are checking up on you, and they are checking up on whether you're doing a good enough job. And if you're not doing a good enough job, what are they going to do? If you're not getting your child vaccinated, what are they going to do? What are the ramifications of that? And I think that's the piece that concerns me, because the government, once it has an in into your home and into your life, is not going away. I would much prefer to see the money spent on trying to get these people out of poverty rather than keeping them on the welfare system. We have 25% of our population in California is living at or below poverty level. We have 250,000 children that are homeless every night. That's ridiculous when we have the seventh largest economy in the world.
Right.
I
we have a million illegal migrants that we're supporting. Sorry.
Yep. No, agree with you. And so, when you look at what can be done, I would much prefer to see those people being taken out of the poverty line and that's what they say they're doing. So they say that, this next generation of children, we are helping them succeed, that they have a job and that they, that we've helped them throughout their life to get there. Well, to me, there has to be a different way. There has to be a different way to help these people get out of poverty and not be reliant on the state system. And part of it is there's this band of income that you either earn below and you're completely on the state system and you get, health paid for, you get food, you get a whole bunch of different things. And between that threshold and actually being able to live on your own without government assistance, having health care benefits, having food, having, everything that you need to sustain yourself, there's about a $20,000 to $30,000 to $40,000, depends where you live, which is why the difference, gap in being subsidized for everything to being able to really truly support yourself. And
right.
So people stay below that level because there's no way you get a $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 jump in your salary. It just isn't. I mean, unless you're, you know, even with a college education, you're not jumping to something that usually you're not jumping that dramatically. And so people stay below that level because they can't make that jump. And if they go, you know, $1 above that level, they now no longer have health benefits. They no longer have food stamps. They no longer have, you know, WIC. They know, I mean, they don't have any of this support system. So there's a bunch of people within the support system that would love to be out of the support system but can't financially do it because of this band where you just don't make enough money to have the benefit. So it's better to make less than that amount to stay within the benefit.
So the home visiting bill would target underserved is what we call them here.
Yeah.
Underserved.
Yeah.
The underserved population. And but, you know, Christina, having a kid with autism and being connected with the regional center in California, they want to see your private documents. They want to know when the last time your son visited the dentist. They want to know when the last time your kid went in for a well baby visit.
Mm-hmm.
Hello, none of your business, but if I want their help, I have to tell them.
Yeah, and I should be very clear. It's not a bill this year. It was a bill last year, but it's actually in the budget. And if it's in the budget, it happens. So it's an interesting.
So it'll be represented.
Yeah, it will happen because it will happen just because it's in the budget. It doesn't need the legislators will pass it because it's part of the budget.
But we need to stop this tyranny right now. We are Americans, and we have a right to privacy. We have a right to go to school. And we have a right to be left alone. We have a right to our religious beliefs, which also includes philosophical beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for as long as I live, I will fight for my freedom and my natural rights.
Yeah. And I think the biggest
parenting rights and your choices on how you want to raise your children.
Yeah. And I think the biggest place. So fighting individual bills is one thing, and, you know, we do that all the time, or supporting individual bills, too. I think the biggest piece of this is in the elections. And, you know, California passed, the voters passed a ballot initiative. I don't remember what year it was, but they passed a ballot initiative that allows the top two members, the top two percentage of votes to go through to the primary. From the primary to the final election. Initially, I mean, I remember that being on the ballot and me thinking, oh, that's a really good idea. Of course you want the top two people to be in the election. You don't want, you know, there to be, it doesn't need to be two parties. Well, it was very, I remember it was very misconceived or, you know, didn't give a lot of education of what it would actually do. But what it has done is it means that you no longer have a two-party system. You have a one-party system that has, you know, the top two Democrats that are running against each other. And that means that, you know, our state is super blue. And so we need to change and we need to be involved in elections and who gets elected and put the pressure on them. And what's interesting is Pan comes out over and over again saying that this is a, you know, we are a single issue. We are single issue voters, which I do believe we are. And that we need to use that to our advantage. We can make a difference in these elections because we are single issue voters and we can make it a piece of the puzzle. I will plug, our petition. And it has to do with, it has to do with SB 276, but it also mostly has to do with the elections. So the elections, especially for assembly members, are more likely to be able to be swayed because they're 500,000 people, but only about 40,000 to 50,000 people come out to vote. And so you can actually make a difference. We have a petition going for SB 277. It's at tinyurl.com/SB276petition. So tinyurl.com/SB276 petition. And what we're looking for is we're looking to, I think we're at about 25,000, which is great. Maybe we may have topped 26,000 this weekend, but we want to get it to 100,000 so that we have enough people in every district to make a difference. And we can go to the legislature and say, look, we've got, you know, 3,000 people in your district that have issue with this bill. And it doesn't matter where you stand on vaccinations. You can be for vaccinations. You can be against vaccinations. Doesn't matter where you stand on it. This is a slippery slope because it's taking away your doctor's right to determine what is best for you and what is best for your child. And so anybody that has a concern with wanting their doctor to be in charge and not a state bureaucrat on any issue, because this is just the first, there will be different ones in the future if we allow this through, they should be signing this petition. So I encourage people, and it really does have to do with the elections, and we have to look in 2020 at who is running and putting up our own people to run or supporting the people that really do take this issue seriously and take our health seriously and take the doctor-patient relationship seriously.
Well, I'm taking my right to choose seriously. You know, it should be my decision, not a bureaucrat and not a doctor. I want my choice.
Sure, absolutely. But absolutely. I mean, this issue right now is you know, doctor-patient.
Yeah, I know.
And, you know, the argument
it shouldn't even be an issue.
Right. No. And I understand that. I mean, the argument is that, you know, you would be told, well, you do have a right. You have a right to choose not to be vaccinated. Your child has a right to choose not to be vaccinated. Now, it doesn't mean to say they can go to school, but you know, ultimately, the answer would be, well, you still have a right to do that. And the answer is, we do. We do as long as there aren't police powers in place, as long as there isn't an outbreak for communicable disease in place. You know, we do have the right to do that. But I think it is, you know, every time they chip away, we're boiling frogs, as I like to say.
Yep.
You know, every time they chip away at something, even if it is a tiny something, and if it's not related to you, in the exact example, but in the greater example, they're chipping away at it, and it's going to come get you, and I'm talking to everybody in this state, they're going to come get you on something that you don't agree with, but you're allowing it with every time that you don't stand up for the issues you believe in, and the issues on the greater level that could fall into your realm in the future.
Right. So, Christina, I have to go, but
yes,
tell us about your upcoming event. Tell us about Live Aware. I don't know if it's upcoming. When is it? Where
it is.
Yep,
October 4th through 6th. So it's not upcoming yet, but it's going to come be around the corner in no time. October 4th through 6th, it's in the San Francisco Bay Area, and it is this year we're focusing on the air around you. So that includes EMF, 5G, wireless. It includes mold. It includes basically, pesticide spraying, basically anything to do with the air, geoengineering, those types of things. And that's our focus this year. So, and we're really excited. We haven't announced our keynote speaker, but I have gotten an email from somebody that I'm super excited about. So, I will let you know when I will put it up there.
So,
you can go to liveaware.com for information on that.
Liveaware.com.
Yep.
And we can go to avoiceforchoiceadvocacy.org.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And we can – now, just one more question. Do you have the questions that you put together on your website about –
So we have them ready to go. We're waiting for the amendments to come through so that we can officially answer – speak to those amendments. So right now the only version we have is the old version, which we do have those questions up on our website. But we believe that amendments will come out today or tomorrow, and when we do, we will have that. And I would encourage people to go onto our website. When you go on for the first time, you can sign up for our newsletter. If you're interested in any of this, please do sign up, and we'll add you to the list, and then you'll get emails. We don't send out emails that aren't important, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
We only send out
been
emails
at this for a really long time, and she's been, you know, I mean, she is my source. For information on what's going on legislatively, and she takes the time to talk to me when it's imperative that we talk. So, Christina, thank you so much.
You're
so welcome. Today's July 1st, and I'll get with you when anything changes. And thank you to our listeners, and thank you to Christina. Be well, Missy.
All right, take care.
Love you. Bye.